Welcome to the wonderful world of wine, exploring all things wine with you. We are your hosts, Mark Lenzi and Kim Simone, and you can find us on Facebook at The Wonderful World of Wine. Hello and welcome to the wonderful world of wine. Every week, Mark and I will introduce topics of importance in the wine world and interview all sorts of fascinating people. And this week, I am thrilled to announce that our guest for the show is Andrea Immer Robinson, whose wine education courses and books I have been a fan of since I started in this industry. And I am so excited to welcome Andrea to the show today. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. How about you guys? How's it going?
Excellent. You know, it's springtime here in Boston, and we're kind of getting going with all sorts of new things. And it's really just absolutely wonderful to have you on the show today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you guys.
Yeah, welcome, Andrea. It's an honor to meet you and have you on the show. And I'm so excited that the listeners are going to learn all about you if they don't know about you yet.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So for our listeners who are not familiar with you and your work, Andrea was one of the first female master sommeliers in the world, in the United States, to attain that certification. She's an educator. She's a sommelier. And you have been doing so many interesting things out of California in the last few years. You live in Napa, correct?
Yes, I live right in the heart of Napa Valley. It's one of the most beautiful places on earth. So it's a great place to both work and live.
Wonderful. We've been interviewing a lot of people over the course of the last year. And I feel like a lot of our focus does tend to be on wine educators and wine media focused people who have more of a footprint in Italy or in France. So it's always wonderful to have someone who has a California focus on the show, because we like to focus on our, you know, our own American wine production. And it's always really refreshing to be able to kind of spread our focus throughout the world. So I'm really interested to hear about what the happenings are in California these days. And as our listeners know, wine is such a seasonally focused product, and every year you kind of never know what you're going to get. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what Napa has been up to lately.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's an exciting time, I'd say, for sure in Napa Valley, but globally, some challenges for sure, but a lot of ingenuity and a lot of global collaboration to come up with solutions. So it's exciting times.
Very cool.
Andrea, I want to ask you something, a topic that I think a lot of people over the years have kind of forgotten about it. And I'm sure it's going to make you sad and a lot of listeners sad, but I'd like our listeners to know your background and your association with the World Trade Center and your New York connection. I noticed over the years you do wonderful tributes to that. And I just want people to really know your story with that whole World Trade Center and New York.
Mark, I'm so glad that you asked. Windows on the World was the restaurant on top of the World Trade Center. And while so many people certainly either were around for and intimately aware of 9/11. We all have our own sort of 9/11 story. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't necessarily remember about the restaurant on top of that, about tower number one, which was Windows on the World. It's really where I cut my teeth in wine, because it had the top restaurant wine program in the country and one of the top restaurant wine programs in the world at the time. And so I came there, first of all, just as a volunteer at the very famous, and justly so, Windows on the World Wine School, which was started by Windows' original wine director, who always stayed involved with the restaurant and continues the wine school virtually to this day. Kevin Zraley is his name. Personal friend and mentor, and inspiration to, for sure, sommeliers really around the globe, but especially the American sommelier and what that became and came to represent. It was a world-class program because it had an extensive wine list, but also one of the biggest things about it that I think people who went there would remember fondly and maybe be a little bit wistful wishing we still had it was really, really customer friendly wine pricing. And so I first came to Windows on the World to volunteer for the wine school as a pourer. Lots of other people there, many, many great wine professionals out there who did the same, be that fellow master sommeliers like Jillian Balance or great wine writers and speakers like Anthony Giglio and so many more. And then I really had that light bulb fixation moment of, I have to leave investment banking and try to follow this as a career.
Everyone has that light bulb moment, don't they?
Yes, we do.
All of us exactly. In this industry. Yeah.
Indeed. And it's funny because I remember the conversation very well with Kevin at the time, him saying, kid, I can't believe you're going to leave the big bucks of Wall Street, but if you do, here's what you need to do. So he mm-hmm. told me I needed to visit the wine regions of Europe to really understand where it all started. And that's really what centered the Windows on the World wine list, was this global focus with certainly a very big specialty in American wines, because that was an emerging category at the time. That restaurant opened in 1976. I volunteered there in the very late 1980s and then started working there as the wine department secretary and wine school coordinator in 1990. Worked there until 1993, the day of the first World Trade Center terrorist attack, which was the van that drove underneath with a makeshift mm-hmm. explosives and created that big close down of the towers for a while. We stored away the wine cellar, and then back in 1996, were able to come back and reopen the restaurant with the original restaurateur who started it all in 1976, and that was Joe Baum. So it came back in a really big way. We had, you know, the great chef Michael LaMonaco, who still has a great restaurant in New York City at the Time Warner Center. And it was a really fantastic sort of ability to come back and start it again with the wine school and everything. And I worked there from 1996 to 1999 and then left to pursue some other things, but was still consulting to the family that operated the restaurant, the Baum and Emil families were the two partners in it. So then, of course, we all know what happened on 9/11 of 2001. And that's, I won't say the end of that story, because we still have the Windows of Hope Foundation, which raised money for the families of displaced workers from there, the families of workers who were in 9/11 and didn't survive, and so on. We still have the Windows on the World Wine School, and of course, Kevin's great book. So, and many, many, many great wine professionals who either came through there having worked there, or great wineries and wines that, especially from an American wine perspective, almost had their debut there and became globally important. Mm-hmm. Things that come to mind are like Mary Edwards, mm-hmm. who I remember the phone call of them saying, you need to taste the wine of this female winemaker. She's, you know, one of the pioneers. And lo and behold, it became a world-class wine. Staglin family. I remember Sherry Staglin, who's here in Napa Valley. They're a fantastic cult wine estate in Rutherford, calling me up and saying, you need to taste our wine and I'm going to bring you some so you can. And it's just, you know, a very beautiful American approach. But that's a long answer to your question, but there's so much to the fabric of Windows on the World and what it did for wine education, and for the sommelier profession.
No, it's so nice every year. I believe you do it every year. I've seen you doing toasts and talking about it. And I just want to thank you for that, for bringing that memory back every year so people know all about it.
It's so important. And you know, because we need to remember for so many reasons, including just, you know, especially I think in this day and age, how it really brought Americans together and how it brought the globe together in support of the United States. We're not perfect just like anybody else, but we're better together. And so by remembering that, I think it's a really, really valuable lesson, aside from the fact that we can talk about it from the perspective of what it meant for hospitality and for wine.
Mm-hmm. And for those of us that were, we don't necessarily see it as history because that's our lived life experience. And to know that there was this other part of it that really did impact hospitality, like you just said, and with our wine industry and just that was into person contact and how much of it is individuals having those personal relationships and how we were all affected by that day.
Indeed.
So, Andrea, let's talk about your book. Kim was saying earlier, she's such a huge fan. I'm such a huge fan of all your wine education. You had this whole education thing about the big six grapes. And I wanted to see if you could just tell our listeners your whole idea behind the big six grapes. And I wanted to ask you, in time, did you change the red grapes? Because I remember you had three and you used Syrah a lot. And then you kind of worked in Merlot and Cab. And I just curious, from my own background and connection with you and your books, did you change that in time? And do you still think the big six are trending in the wine world?
Mark, that is a great question. The big six grapes are, I think, a really great foundation. And what it comes from is a lesson that I learned from Kevin Sraley in his Windows on the World wine book. I took it to a next wrinkle in the importance of the big six. There's three whites, three reds, and I'll answer your question about why there's now, so to speak, four reds. But anyway, the big six grapes are three whites, three reds, but with a little bit of license there. And the idea is that if you learn these grapes, how they're pronounced, and their styles, and that means both body style from light to heavy, because wine is just like food. You consider it in terms of body. I'm really starving. I want to, you know, a stick to your ribs meal, or I want to eat light. We all know what that means. Well, with wine grapes and body, we also can use that because that helps us select stylistically what we're looking for, just like it does with food. But it also helps us pair, and we can talk more about that in a second. But the other importance of these grapes, because there are thousands of outstanding and interesting and exciting wine grapes. These are, though, a couple of things. First of all, they're responsible for the globally important classic wines. They're what master of wine candidates and people with that title would call the noble grapes, because they are the source grape for the world's classic wines from the original HQ of global wine quality, which is France. Now, that doesn't mean that France always has made the best wine or makes the best wine today, but it absolutely makes some of the world's global quality and style benchmark wines. So the whites are Riesling, then Sauvignon Blanc as you move up the scale in body, then Chardonnay for the fullest in body. The reds, starting with Pinot Noir, and then it used to be Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon. And that was inspired by the way Kevin was teaching. However, over time, two things happened. First of all, it became more and more clear as the Meritage movement came to be, where they're blending Merlot and Cabernet with other grapes from its historic regional homes, which is the Bordeaux region of France. Then Syrah, called Shiraz in Australia, really started trending in the 2000s. And so it became, it's always been a noble grape variety from France as Syrah from the Rhone Valley region of France, but it was gaining traction. I'd say it's lost its footing a bit, but I think still as a noble grape, it's also important. So what I ended up doing was compressing in the middle Merlot with Cabernet Sauvignon, because they both hail from Bordeaux in France. Both are classically blended, but are the leading actors in the key Chateau wines of Bordeaux's top communes. By focusing on those grapes, the three whites, the four now red, but Merlot and Cabernet are such common blending partners that I'm comfortable kind of almost making a contraction with them. We really are able to see styles, both in terms of body, but also just classical taste profiles on which many of the world's global wines are modeled. So if you get a Chardonnay from anywhere in the world, it is modeled on a white Burgundy wine from France, where that grape originally hails from. So it's sort of like taking the mothership and saying, if I get those down, then I really have a strong grasp of a huge number of the world's high quality wines. And then you can go from there, right? And you can compare body styles and taste profiles of other grape varieties to those core, in the same way that if somebody says, I've never had squab, what is that like? And they say, well, it's like chicken, but a little bit more intense flavor. The chicken, beef, the vanilla and chocolate of the wine world are the big six grapes.
Yeah, like giving people a springboard and then, you know, something else to reach for that they have at least something in common with what they are used to eating or tasting or smelling.
Precisely. There. Oh, Kim, yeah. You said it better. You should write a book, girl. I love it.
Appreciate that.
You
Thank
always
you.
Made it so easy to go from your book, and then you made your videos, and you took us right into the kitchens and always showed us the flavors in a glass. It was just amazing how you transitioned mm-hmm. from the book to video content. And Kim and I both use that all the time for our education. So we appreciate and thank you for that.
Oh my goodness. No, thank you. It's one of those things where I think when, especially with video, what I love about it is, first of all, you have audio so people can hear how things are pronounced. They
Very
can rewind,
important. Absolutely.
Right? Things like that. But also with video, it's a little bit like the difference between learning something just from a book and learning something with at least one other input. Mm-hmm. Because if I say it tastes like mangoes and pineapples and I show you a picture of that on the video, it's just this additional implanting of the knowledge or the information. And then if you hear the word pronounced as well, it's like when they say, read it, do it, write it, teach it, then you're going to know it.
Yep.
You know, all those different inputs really help. So video helps us do that much more so than the printed word. That's why I think podcasts are fantastic. I mean, I can be on a drive and listen to The Wonderful World of Wine and not feel like I'm wasting my time. Not that I shouldn't be instead maybe listening to some, you know, classic rock or something, but sometimes I want to be hearing, taking in new information, and things like y'all's podcast is a great way to do it.
And you never know from your students' perspectives who learns better by reading it, who learns better by hearing it, who learns better by doing it. So by having, yeah, all of this kind of new tech that we've been all experimenting with, I think, for the last few years, and especially when the pandemic hit, where we all had to like really pivot with our teaching style and kind of do all of these new things and get on calls and get on all these video things. I think it's been a boon to the different learning styles that different people have. So, you know, moving beyond just books and being able to have all of this other stuff that can present all of this wine education to people in all these different ways.
I totally agree. And honestly, I use so many of the tools all the time. I use Quizlet to like quiz myself on.
I love Quizlet.
Yeah, it's great.
And taking things that my kids are using at school and be like, oh, I can use that in one of my classes. Like, okay.
So true. There's so much great stuff there. And the other thing, Mark, about video is that when you can take people there to the region visually, it's a whole different experience. It's so much richer. And I think that is a big part of what the allure of wine is. I mean, the history and the beauty and the distinctiveness of these places that goes back centuries and creates that connection that we want with each other, you know, human beings that live now, but also creates that connection to our history and our patrimony and tradition and agriculture, which we get pretty distanced sometimes from them. And agriculture is life itself, right? It's if we don't have farming, we don't have a future, period.
You're listening to The Wonderful World of Wine. We are your hosts, Mark Lindsay and Kim Simone, exploring all things wine with you. Our program is supported by Franklin Public Radio. You can find us on Facebook at The Wonderful World of Wine. Today, we have a very special guest, Andrea Robinson. You can find her on her website at andreawine.com. If you want more information about Kim, you can find her at commonwealthwineschool.com. For more information about myself, please go to franklinliquors.com. Our past episodes are on SoundCloud and iTunes. Andrea, you had mentioned video and taking us to a place on the video, and I have to talk to you about your Simply Wine show. When you were doing that show, I ran out and bought a DVD recorder, and I recorded every episode. And that show was something that has really never been done again. And I want to thank you for the great quality you did in that. You were just a natural on video and education on those shows. And I just wanted to ask you a couple of things, the highlights that I kind of liked about it that you did. You did it like a label breakdown, and you showed the labels and you talked about the brands and the wineries. And that's something that now on the shows, they block everything out. What has changed in TV land that people don't do a show like you did and highlight the things like you did?
You know, it's a really interesting question because now, and thank you for the compliment, by the way. I loved that show and I really felt that it was a bit of a groundbreaking approach in the sense that the title delivered. Simply Wine, it really sought to simplify, but without losing the allure, right? Because part of the allure is these amazing places and these experiences, but they don't have to all be expensive or precious or exclusive. And, you know, when you think about wine's European roots, it's a peasant beverage, right? Fundamentally, and something that people don't put too much fluff into, except when they do, right? In the same way that we can get excited, I can get so excited about a BLT and I can get so excited about my brined turkey at Thanksgiving and everything in between, right? So it's just like food, like anything else. Love me a t-shirt and some leggings and it's fun to dress up, right? We're all across the board and wine is no different. But Simply Wine was what changed, Mark, to your question, I think, is that TV became more and more about the reality show format. Because basically, if you're not voting somebody out of the kitchen or off the island, or it basically using sensationalized behavior and conflict for viewership. So it's a little bit like I hate saying this because some of the shows that are competition shows are still pretty cool, sort of. I don't have any that I really love. But for some reason, that's really just what audiences would eat up. And so that's what advertisers would fund. I think now, though, that maybe there's an opportunity to bring it back in the sense that with the internet and the ability to stream, we don't have gatekeepers in the form of networks. We have them, but it doesn't stop you from producing high quality content. You have to have a way to monetize it, and that can be difficult. But at the same time, wine, at least in our country, is a long tail product, meaning everyone eats food, not everyone drinks wine. Some of the reason that they don't, though, is because this gatekeeper barrier element to it. So I think that we could fix that. And, you know, my hope is to do that. But I'm going to try to make sure to do it right. I think brands have to be talked about. We're there. You're a retailer. Kim, you're an instructor. We're there to point people in the right direction, mm-hmm. right? And that doesn't mean that there's no other wine than the one we talk about that's worthy. There's tons. It's just a step in the empowerment thing in the same way that you call up your friend who's really handy to say, look, which power tool drill brand should I get on sale at the Home Depot. So we are there to make it great for people to experiment on their own, but also to give them a jumping off point. And I think we can do better and more and get away from the sensationalized. I think people would much rather be told what are some great wines to get rather than this is swill and I can't wait to trash it or whatever, yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And to your point, it's for those of us who are in the industry and have been in the industry for a really long time and have a lot of experience, we are definitely looked to by our friends and family and whatever for unbiased, real advice. And it's very hard for people who just sort of drink wine casually to just go into a wine store and be like, okay, Kim said that blah, blah, blah style of wine is something good that I should get, but there are all these brands in front of you. So to be able to point to very specific bottles for people and be like, buy that one.
Exactly.
We don't have to be viewed as somebody who's like, we don't get any sort of cut for promoting those wines or anything. It's just like, well, at the end of the day, we want to be able to point people in the right direction. And whether it's a style or whether it's appellation or whether it's a producer, it really helps us and it helps the consumer to be able to point out specific ones that we rely on and that we like and that we know that are good indications of either it tastes good or this is what this style of wine should taste like. So I think that brands, it's something that we probably should talk about more, frankly.
Well said. I totally agree.
I'm so happy I recorded them because I'm sure there's listeners out there now who are saying, well, I got to find that show. If you haven't seen it, it's almost impossible to find on the internet now. And I just keep watching them all the time. I loved your whole 60-second sommelier at the end, how you just wrapped up the show and you had so many good education points at the end of each show. It was really just groundbreaking for wine education and television. And I hope you think about bringing it back and doing something more with that, because it was just a great show.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think let's say all stay tuned and we'll all join forces and figure out how to make it make sense. How about
yeah,
that?
Put a little reality in there somewhere. That's all. They'll pick it right up.
Oh, goodness. We don't need any more competition shows on TV. But to that point, I want to know what you've been up to lately. I know you've got some things going on in California. You have a wine glass line that you have on your website. You do some other educational platforms. I really want to hear about what your current projects are.
Wonderful. Thank you for asking. You know, the One stemware, it's called The One because it's a single shape that's optimized to enhance all grapes. And this is something that's been a labor of love that I started many years ago. There's now some other glasses with a, I'm going to call it a Me Too concept because they came later. But it's the idea that you need a different shape for every grape. And initially, at least, the grape-specific glasses were concepted around where the liquid hits on your tongue, mm-hmm. Which is, I think even those grape-specific glass lines have backed away from that because we've all come to realize, and this is why I went in the direction I did with the One stemware, it's really the aromas in wine that give you flavor, right? Your tongue and your palate give you temperature, texture, and that. So that's important, right? Because you get the body on the palate, you get textural elements like tannin, bubbles, temperature, etc. And then the tastes, so sweet and acid that you get in wine, those all are things that your palate can clue you into, but all flavor comes from smell, right? So if the glass is not optimizing the aroma, and I determined after lots and lots of blind tasting with the existing best glasses out there, because early in the game, I figured out that the Burgundy, the one that was originally sort of that everyone models off of Riedel's Venom glass, the Burgundy mm-hmm. shape was the best for all reds. And there was a particular glass that was best for all whites, that it's the aromatic enhancement that I was looking for. So I spent a bunch of time figuring out what are the aspects of the glass design, specifically the bowl shape, but the thinness of the rim is important too. What are those aspects that really optimize the aromatics, regardless of grape? Are they the same? Can one shape do it or not? The determination after lots, about 3 years of comparative tasting with some prototypes, was absolutely yes. It also worked across styles and quality levels, right? So you could optimize a $7, I don't know if it's still that now, but a $7 at the time, Lindeman's Bin 65 Chardonnay?
I don't think it's seven that. Anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Darn it.
How about we talk about anyway, 2 Buck Chuck? That'll work.
There you go. So that is absolutely a wine that I tasted in my comparative trials for sure.
I'm sure.
Yeah. And so the aromatics are what's key. So that's why I invented the glass, is really to get away from the different glass for every grape. It's already complicated without having to complicate your glassware life or make that extra investment in space and money. And I've been really, really happy with it. It's essentially a product that sells itself by word of mouth. And then some of the other aspects that were important to me were break resistance. It's not breakable, you know, unbreakable. No glass product or crystal product is unbreakable, but quite durable. And I wanted it to be affordable because, again, sometimes they are going to break, number one. And number two, what you're really wanting to be investing in is the wine. And as long as the glass really does the best that it can for it, then that's really all I'm looking for. And I really am proud of it because, for example, the Domaine de la Romanée Conti, the Burgundy, famous Burgundy estate in France, they use the glass for their trade tastings for the new release every year in New York City. This is after trying it and deciding that that's really the glass they want to use. So it doesn't have to be expensive to be good in terms of the glass. It does have to be the right shape, and that's what the one represents.
Is it only sold on your website, Andrea?
You know, it's sold at a few very high-end retailers around the country, and it's sold here and there at some of the on-premise establishments that use it, also offer it for sale. But mostly, yes, it is just on the website. I do fulfill through Amazon. Some people may think that that's a bad thing, but most people are pretty committed to free shipping these days. We've all been trained by that very large company. And so when I'm trying to make sure that the product can get to people in good shape for the best possible price, that's at least so far the best solution I've found. Yeah. So it's essentially on andreawine.com is the place to find it.
And that really sort of fits with your whole, I think, point of view for your approach to wine and your approach to wine education, so that this is something that anybody can appreciate and anybody can enjoy. And having a simplified wine glass line that you don't need seven different shapes of wine glasses is, I think, really appreciated now. And Mark and I, we talk about this all the time, that we've both been in the business for a really, really long time. And we see trends come and go. And we see this sort of like bell curve of things that are fashionable and things that fall out of fashion. And when I got married, it was at the height of the, you need eight different shapes of wine glasses because, you know, you need to have something for every single grape variety that you like. And now it's really come back to the other side of things. And so I think that what you have and what you have experimented with and done your research on really does sort of fit with the way that people are approaching wine these days, not only in the wine glass line, but also in the way that you approach wine education.
Well, that's really just over the years, and as an educator, you know exactly what I'm talking about, Kim. And Mark is a retailer. We've all seen people walk into a store and just like
Deer in the
gripped with,
headlights. Deer in the
oh,
headlights.
yeah, as though you can make a mistake. And I think there is a little like you can't go wrong, but at the same time, it doesn't, no one likes to feel like they're making a bet. And we're scared to not spend a lot because we've been told that spending more is like an insurance policy for quality, even though it really isn't, right? And it's not an insurance policy even for that you'll like it, much less the quality piece. I mean, you can just find incredible quality wines for good prices. To me, the whole idea of just reducing any and all barriers to people feeling confident in and excited about wine, that's why we're here. And whether it's you as a retailer, Mark, or you as an educator, Kim, and we know that people want it because they're coming to us.
I'm glad that we've gotten to this point with exposing and not just a whole new generation of people to wine, but people who maybe their family background was not that they had any exposure to wine growing up. And now people are really curious and really interested. And I think this whole generation of wine educators that we have, who not only in my school, but all over the place, really are embracing that and are really very hopefully welcoming people of all sorts of backgrounds and knowledge levels into the, hey, come learn about wine, come taste wine with us, come see what it's all about, and don't be afraid to not come in with a whole bunch of already like institutional knowledge. And wine can be fun, and we'll try to make it less snobby and less intimidating for you.
Yeah, and maybe that is something that, as much as some of the like sort of internet platforms are maybe dumbing things down a little much, I think overall, having more and more diverse voices that aren't necessarily always just like the ultimate wine experts or have a credential or whatever is good, because what we used to say with a television show is, and like so many other things, if you can see yourself in that setting, then you're interested. If you can't, then you're just like, moving on, never mind, that kind of thing. And so when people see themselves and hear language with which they're comfortable and familiar, that's the secret sauce, in my opinion.
Yeah, that whole language thing is a whole nother show.
Indeed. Yes.
Andrew, I wanted to follow up on your selecting wine because I know you did a lot of shows where you were in supermarkets, you were in fine wine shops, and you were kind of talking the differences between shopping and those. And you did recommend, you said, don't shy away from buying wine in supermarkets at that time. Do you feel that has changed now that there's more differences with like big brands are being focused on more in the supermarkets? markets than fine wine shops? You think it's changed, or you still feel you can get good wines in supermarkets like you did in the past?
You know, Mark, it's a great question. And I think that you're pointing out something that is absolutely true, which is that a lot of big box retailers and big supermarkets do focus on the big brands. And I don't know if it's the tail wagging the dog or not, because those are big brands for a reason. The maybe average consumer sees them and they're comfortable with them. And so you sort of need to have on the shelf what people are looking for. But at the same time, some of the supermarket chains, especially regionally and specific to their area, even of a location, will be edging people out. I see it with the Albertsons Safeway group here, which is Safeway's one of the big California supermarket chains. They have a master of wine, vice president of wine, and they have, I believe, another master of wine on staff. But in any case, and my local Safeway here in Little St. Helena has a pretty extensive assortment. It has all the usual suspects, the big brands like you're talking about, but it also has quite a lot of edged out wines. Now, it's more difficult for them to merchandise those because the big brands, literally, just like the Tide detergent does, they have their own team members who come in, put up the shelf talkers, organize the section and merchandise, and even do adjacencies with a cheese or a pasta sauce or something to give people something to go on. I still really do love the sort of beauty and specificity of retailers that are specialists, though, because they're positioned to bring a breadth of wine to life. And probably that's going to be like the biggest challenge for the supermarket chains these days, because what we're seeing with the new generation of wine consumer is they don't necessarily want to drink the big brands that they saw on the counter at their parents' home. They're ready for new stuff. And they're like, bring it on. What do you got? If I haven't heard of it, I'm that much more interested. So I think that's going to be a challenge for them and an opportunity for the smaller independent retailers.
This is what we're seeing in Massachusetts, where, you know, we only probably, 10, 15 years ago opened up our retail to a lot more grocery stores having alcohol sections and, you know, some of the bigger stores having a footprint in the state. So it really has been this shift between kind of those larger, more grocery store, more chainy things and stores like Mark's store that, in order to survive, they really have to focus on smaller producers, education, those more interesting things, and focus on that more to just... How would you describe it, Mark, the way that you focus on what you bring into your store as opposed to those kind of bigger brands?
Yeah, more wines with the story. More,
yeah, the story.
Family.
Exactly.
The people,
yeah.
The people we meet and you know who's behind them.
Yeah.
I think it's
everything you bring in, it has that like story behind it. And you do, you know, you taste every single thing that you bring in. And it's this idea that every bottle has this unique character to it, whether it's how it's made or who has made it or where it's from, and this unique footprint to each of those wines. So yeah, there's definitely this differentiation, I think, not only through what different retailers are offering, but also, like you said, sort of generational buying and the new generation of wine drinkers who's coming up. And do they want to shift their focus from what they remember their parents consumed to what they are interested in? And it's not just here in the US. I mean, we see this all the time for shifting consumption patterns in Europe and in Asia and all these things. So yeah, it's a worldwide phenomenon.
And exciting, because it's such a global world of wine now that it's great to have that foundation in the classics. And I don't mean the expensive classics. I just mean the classic grapes and the regions that they hail from, having that understanding. But it's just that jumping off point, kind of like food, right?
I was going to bring it back to food, because you talked about food a little bit earlier and experimenting with food, but also how like wine and food go together. But it's all about the agriculture. And so it's not just about the wine and where the wine is from, but everything that we consume has that story. And where did it come from? And how does that tie back to not only where the food is from, but how we perceive it and how we conceptualize it. And that's like, that's my big thing about food and the whole meaning about why we eat what we eat. And it totally ties into wine as well.
It really does. And the food part of it, it's the, that's the irony, is like, it's, and in, and to that, I do give the Food Network, which is now the Food Game Show Network in a way, like we were talking about before, but the original Food Network really opened up the, you know, people's eyes to food as something more than fuel. And that's where you had, and before that, public television, God bless public television, and Pierre Frenet and Cuisine Rapide and Justin Wilson and the Cajun.
Julia.
And,
yay, Julia.
Oh, Julia, the goddess. And when you look at that and you say, gosh, I mean, that caught Americans' imagination and ardor. Well, why should wine be any different? Mm-hmm. So that really, I think, especially in the 80s and really the 1990s, the Food Network kind of like, it turned people on. I remember getting into New York City cabs and having people start talking, you know, having the cabbie start talking to me about restaurants and food, and the Salvadorian street festival is going to be between this block and that block this weekend. And you can have, you know, their version of an empanada or whatever. And it's like, this is great.
And so. I started my food studies at the same time. So it was like totally, totally the same sort of vibe in Boston as it was in New York. Yeah.
Love it.
I'm glad we finally got on food before we ended the show, because Andrew, you have to tell us, Andrew, what was your culinary background? Because you had the Pairings with Andrea show, and my wife is going to kill me if I don't mention this to you, Andrea, but she handed me a recipe that she uses of yours all the time from that show, the Andrea's Alphabet Soup. And she wanted me to tell you she loved the show and she loved that recipe. She makes it all the time. We have a little problem finding the little alphabet noodles there, but
they are hard to find.
They are, tell our these days they are hard
about
to find.
Your background. I mean, you worked it into your show so well with the wine and your passion for food in the kitchen. It was just great. So if you could just tell our listeners a little bit about your food background.
Well, first of all, thanks. And thanks for that. And hey to your wife and tell her thank you. But honestly, that's the funny part, is that was my first passion, was food and cooking. And this is within the context of my kind of middle America upbringing, where my dad worked for the Pillsbury Company. So we had refrigerated dough in every form or fashion you could imagine. Refrigerated biscuits, refrigerated slice and bake cookie dough, refrigerated croissant, crescent rolls, and all that stuff. And all of that, at the time that consumer packaged goods were really exploding, especially on foods that were convenient, as more and more women were working outside the home and stuff like that, where everyone was making recipes using these things. And that's where I started, with the Pillsbury Bake Off book. And then I got, for my fifth birthday, I got the Nancy Drew cookbook.
So, we should talk more offline, you and me.
But anyway, so I was really avid into food and cooking, and it really started there. I got more sophisticated, way less processed and packaged. I'm not criticizing that, but I think it's really, really important that we all get back to more in the ingredient in the closest form to how Mother Nature created it, as opposed to like excessive processing for our health, right? Primarily for our health. And I think also for sustainability and planet reasons. I look at what I look at in the grocery store. I think, you know, how much trash am I making with that purchase? And is there a way I can reduce that? Can I make a different choice? But anyway, so it started with that. And then I actually already had my master sommelier credential when I went to culinary school. So that was much later in the game, when I decided, hey, I want knife skills. I want classical technique. I want to understand this. It was after my first book, and when I was getting prepared to write the food and wine pairing book that you were talking about. And I was so glad I did, because it really, really crystallized my understanding of what makes food and wine so compatible. And it's real simple. It's the acid in the wine. Acid is like a condiment. Every condiment in your refrigerator, if it's not salty, it's got acidity to it. And that's what we use to launch other flavors. That's the role that wine plays, and that's why they are so suited to one another.
Was that your intention for going to cooking school, was to have it be this sort of complement to the wine part of it? Or did you have a different objective?
It was entirely that, going to mm-hmm. cooking school to really crystallize my understanding of food and the dynamics of flavor preparation techniques and how they impact it. And yeah, so it was, that book was underway when I started the culinary program at the French Culinary Institute, but it really was very, very influential in how I put so many of those concepts together because it affected my understanding.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Andrea. Kim and I could go on forever.
I know,
we accept so much. We appreciate everything. And we want to thank you for everything you've done in the wine world and the education you've provided. Kim and I are examples of your work and passion in the wine world. So we just want to thank you and thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. And you guys get out here to Napa Valley, and I think you should record a podcast on site, and we'll figure out how to do that.
Okay.
So I'll see you there.
All right. Luckily, my brother lives in California, so maybe I'll
Fantastic.
Be dragging Mark with me the next time I go visit him.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank All you right. so much for this, and thank you for the great podcast. And I've really, really enjoyed this, and we have so much more to talk about next time.
Thank you. Well, we really appreciate you being on the show with us today. And yeah, what just a wonderful conversation, and we always love talking about food and wine, and I didn't even get to talk about bubbles, but next time we'll talk about bubbles. Thank you for listening to us today on The Wonderful World of Wine. We have been your hosts, Mark Lenzi and Kim Simone, with Andrea Robinson. You can find more information about her at andreawine.com, and our past episodes are on SoundCloud and iTunes, and we are on Franklin Public Radio. Cheers!
Cheers!